Great. Welcome.
I believe I have finished the slides last week, right? There was nothing that I was supposed to finish.
No.
So today, I hope you have watched the movie that I send you a link to. It's short, but quite interesting. A student sent brought me a tape in 1990s when this happened, and it was before they got the Nobel Prize. But I found it quite exciting. I've been using that tape since then. It's a very interesting discovery, not exactly in the field of engineering, it's physics, but still it has a lot of elements that are worth looking at. So today we will just look at, spend a little bit of time talking about that movie, the important elements, and then some general things that we can read out of that movie. So this is a movie about the discovery of another form of carbon. Carbon, as you remember, is a very important element. Life is based on carbon. And they knew just two forms of carbon before that discovery. This is a third form of carbon. Fantastic importance, but also many applications in engineering, as you saw later. Then, after some of the things from the movie that are worth reminding you, I'll talk a little bit about the social character of science. It's surprising how social science is, and you saw it in the movie also. And then the basic mechanisms of science. The things that you probably will encounter daily in your work as a scientist. So here's where we are. How does science work? The link is correct. I have checked it before sending it to you, so I hope you had no difficulties with it. There was one of you who asked me about listening to the recordings of the classes. If you just click on that link, I think the browsers are not supporting that format, but if you save the file as an MP3 text sound file, you can play it locally, definitely under Windows. So if you have difficulties with that, let me know, but I think it should work, just saving and listening to it locally. So, about 50 minutes, the movie, it was worth watching. I believe I sent you the link, list of things to look at, how they picked problems, how they got funding, etc. So, very interesting things that are shown in the movie. The question is, how did they get into the research area? You must have noticed that it was, in many cases, it was an accident, just an accident. Accidents prefer prepared minds, so you have to be just normally curious, and if you find something interesting, just, you know, start asking questions, start getting into it. Many of them got there by accident. How did they pick the problems to work on? As doctoral students, you saw several doctoral students there. I think it was Smalley's lab in Texas. You saw students, not in Kratos lab in England. I think there were mainly American students there. So students get their problems typically from advisors, but the advisors get into an area. Sometimes it's just an accident. Smalley would not be focusing on that if not for Croto, who came from England, wanted to do some experiments. The experiments turned out something interesting. The spikes in the spectrum that got their interest. Why are they? Why are they repeatedly spikes? They are not noise. There's something going on there. There was also a question of funding. If you remember, in the beginning, there was no funding. It was a new idea, new area. So Harry Kroto decided to visit Smalley because he wanted to test some things, and everything is big in Texas, as you hear it later. Smalley had a big lab, a lot of resources, they could do experiments there. That's an American saying, everything is big in Texas. Everything is big in US, but Texas is special. When I first came to US, I was laughing inside me most of the time. I landed for the first time, rented a car, and was driving, and I saw the potholes in the streets of New York, things that you see in movies, you know, wow, do they have those holes in the road like that? I saw a hydrant spouting with water, just like in movies. A car was passing me, I saw the beginning of the car, then long middle, and then the end, that was a limousine. I went to dinner the first evening, I got like that big of a steak, you know, like half a cow on the plate, very unusual for Europeans. Then supermarket and milk in half gallon containers, wow. And there are even gallon containers. Gallon is 4 liters, you know, you buy milk with 4 liters, wow. So amazing. Everything is big in Texas, in US and in Texas also. So a lot of resources, a lot of money, a lot of people makes it easy to do research. Another thing is, so how did they get funding? In the beginning, there was the guy in Texas had money, had labs, so that you could do experiments. In the beginning, it was very difficult to get money. At some point, if you remember, Croteau, the British guy, withdrew money from his wife's account to fly to Texas. Sometimes you have to do things like that. You have to use your own money. Hopefully not too often, but take risks. Smalley, I think he, at some point, they needed vacuum cleaners. He connected several vacuum cleaners, I think, or things from just a regular department store from Sears, I think. So they did things like that. Not the things prescribed by the book, like, you know, here is what you do, you ask for money, you specify what you need. There is a Przetarg, which is, you know, they have offerings, they pick suppliers. No, you just do things. That's what often happens. And being daring sometimes is a good idea. I remember I was daring like that, I think. There is a rule with dealing with administration. When you ask somebody, can I do that, typical answer is no, you cannot do that, that's not allowed by the rules. So I invented a new tense in English, a future past perfect, I called it, I think. It's may I have done something already, you know, I've done it already, and then you ask permission later. You do something and then you ask permission, is it okay to have done it? The same tense in Polish, of course, czas przyszły dokonany. Czy mogłem już coś zrobiłem? And they did a little bit like that. You notice that. They did some unconventional things. If there is no money, then, you know, what do you do? But when they had their first papers and people noticed that there is something big in it, big in that, they had money pouring on them. People were coming to them, do you want some money? That's typical in life, in startup companies. When you start with an idea, so difficult to get funding. But once you get money from one organization, everybody wants in. Everybody wants to give you money. Me too, me too, me too. It's very, very human. And you notice a little bit of that here. Another thing that that is worth remembering about the movie is when they have decided to publish their results. It was... depending on the people. There was this guy in, I think, Kretschmer, in Black Forest in Germany. They published something, but they were not very very happy about it, I think. And the people in the Texas lab, the Croteau and Smalley, they were waiting with publishing because they didn't understand the data, the thing. Only once they had a model, they realized that the molecules of... the atoms of carbon may be bonding with each other in a way that Buckminster Fullerenes do, only then they dared to publish something. It was difficult in the beginning. And then somebody scooped them. In English you say, I'm being scooped. So that the situation when you have an idea, you've worked on it, but somebody else has a solution and publishes it before you. So they used that term, we were scooped, I think. That's when there was a study, I think the guy who visited Germany, the guy from Arizona, they found an easy way of actually observing the Buckminster Fullerenes under a microscope. An easy way, just looking into SUD. They didn't have that idea. So I think they talk about them as being scooped. We'll talk more about this. Another thing that is worth noticing is the globality of science. Especially towards the end of the movie, in the beginning, of course, too, an American guy from Arizona goes to Germany, to Black Forest, to spend his sabbatical. Why there? There may be many reasons. Maybe it was a similar area. Maybe the guy in Germany had money for him to supplement his salary. Maybe they knew each other from a conference. Remember the networking idea. Why did Croto fly to Texas? He probably met Smalley. I forgot how they met, but probably they met in a conference. They had a discussion. Smalley said what he had in his lab. He was very interested. He wanted to perform an experiment. So he said, I would like to come to you, spend some time. He said, sure, come. Right? And at some point he came. Another thing that towards the end of the movie, when they show, I think it was Exxon. Did you notice they talk to different people? They show how there is an explosion of research in this area. You notice young scientists from China, India, I forgot where else, but they were from all over the world. Yes, that's another thing that you will see in science. World without borders. The same rules everywhere, the same methods. If the rules are different, typically they are different in places that are not very well advanced. I would say the US is a very important place for research, and you see that the way the science works there, you saw that in the movie, it is working more or less everywhere. And all over the world, there are people coming from different countries to do their PhDs in US, to work there, then they go back to their places. Chinese science is also advancing rapidly, but there are so many US-trained scientists in China. When you go to Singapore, I spent a year in Singapore, you will notice that most of the faculty in universities there, I was at the National University of Singapore, I think, NUS, almost everybody there was trained in United States, in United Kingdom, Cambridge, Oxford, top universities. So when they organize science there, they take the best, they look at the best places, best source, places where they do science. The same in other countries, of course, you will notice. So it's really global. Networking, you saw it. People, why did the guy go to Black Forest? Why did he fly to Texas? It's all networking. You meet those people accidentally, you talk to them at conferences. I think it's generally a good idea not to be too shy. And people are, of course, different. You need to develop in yourself this daring to just talk to people. I see the differences. My wife, for example, she's rather shy. We go to a big place, a party, 20, 30 people. She will talk to one person for the whole evening. That's okay. You know, she meets that person very well. I talk probably to 10 different people during that evening. There are people who talk to all 30. I'm not that superficial, but I quickly find topics to talk about with people. Good idea, really. And then when you have a good conversation, people remember you. So then when you need something, when you go somewhere, you can easily get in touch with them. They will remember you. You can talk, you can correspond, you can keep in touch. Really good idea to to be like this, to talk to people, to build a network. So definitely, you saw that in the movie, and you should do it. Another thing that you saw was types of scientific career paths. You didn't see every one of them. You saw the university, academia, and also industry. You saw Exxon. There were scientists there doing work. So there are two. There are actually more paths than this. So Buckminster Fuller Innes, the atoms of carbon connecting in a variety of ways. Interestingly, that this is a football, five pentagons and hexagons. You need, it's mathematically studied. You need so many pentagons and hexagons. You need, when you connect hexagons, you need one pentagon for every five hexagons to form this ball. Very interesting. So the remarks about the movie, how did they get into the research area? We'll talk about finding research topics and career planning. You see that there are certain tricks that people are using a lot. In this case, they were picking hard problems. The hard problem, carbon is such an important element, what are the forms of carbon? You know, we know graphite, we know diamond, the two forms of pure carbon. And they discovered the third form of pure carbon, with probably many applications. Unusual experiences. Croto wanted to do architecture, so he knew Buckminster Fuller and his work. You never know when your experiences are going to be useful. I have a little bit of to say about that when we have a meeting on creativity. It turns out that you can stimulate your creativity. So you cannot say, I'm not creative, he or she is creative. Everybody can become more creative. And there are certain tricks that you can use to become more creative. One of those tricks is exposing yourself to as many things as possible. Being really open, active, looking at things, learning things. That's one way of improving your creativity. And Croto was, you could say, creative. How on earth did he think about carbon forming spheres and figures? Very easy to explain. He knew the work of Buckminster Fuller, who was fascinated with those geodesic spheres, I think. That's what they call it, yes? You saw the enthusiasm in the people. That's another thing that is typical. When you do something that really interests you, you will be enthusiastic. If you are not enthusiastic, perhaps you should change the topic. Of course, it's risky to change it like that, you know, immediately, but start drifting towards things that interest you. Because enthusiasm is very important. You'll be more productive, you will work gladly, you will work more hours just because you like it. Coincidences, you saw several of them. Persistence also, not just giving up. Some of them gave up. The guy who visited Black Forest, what was his name? Kretschmer, I think. No, Kretschmer was the German guy. I forgot the name of the guy from Arizona. He thought it was junk, right? He gave up. Okay, it's just junk. But the others studied it more carefully. Coincidences often are very important surprises. Funding. Some places have more resources than other places. Smallest lab in Texas, and everything is big in Texas, so they have money. And once you show something, it's very easy to get money. Croto got government funding once he had published his Nature paper. Nature, by the way, we'll talk about it more, is one of the leading journals in physics. There are two, Science and Nature. Publishing there is almost like within your field, close to being close to Nobel Prize. You know, it's really not easy to get there. They publish usually very, very important findings. So publishing in Nature, that was actually quite a big achievement. Sometimes they use personal funds. We just talked about this. It may turn out to be a good investment. It depends. vacuum cleaner, air ticket from his wife's bank account, he said. Maybe he was joking, but maybe he talked to his wife also. I would not imagine taking her money and not telling her about this. And publishing, there is always this balance between publishing early because you want to be first. In science, only the first person gets a reward. Second, it's nice, maybe the person is smart, but there is a saying in that about that in English and in Polish, he reinvented the wheel. You know that expression. Maybe he or she is very, very smart because inventing a wheel is actually quite a smart thing. It's not an easy thing to do. If you think it's easy, then think why not every civilization had a wheel. In fact, wheel was in Europe, Asia. Was it in Africa? I don't know. Not in Americas. In Americas, there were several big civilizations, but they didn't have a wheel. You could say Incas were walking in the mountains, right? Sometimes high mountains. Okay, wheel might not be very useful. Aztecs could use a wheel because there were hills around Mexico City, but there were roads, there were flat areas. They could use a wheel, they could use carts. Mayans, it depends which region of Yucatan or Guatemala, but they built roads in Yucatan. Yucatan is flat in many, many areas, so they built roads, but they never invented a wheel. Very interesting. They had actually toys, like a toy that is like a llama or something, with very small wheels under it. But they never used a wheel the size of a cart wheel. A smart thing, most very brilliant things, very smart things are obvious, but only once you have them. Before you have them, they are not obvious at all. That's an important principle. Brilliant things are obvious, but once you have them, before you have them, you don't think about them. So only the first person in science gets the acknowledgement. Mr. Kowalski is the person who proposed the following theory, right? If Mr. Wiśniewski finds the same theory, okay, that was smart of him, but he will never get it published because there was already Wiśniewski published it. Yes, Kowalski published it, so that's it. So you want to be first, but on the other hand, you don't want to be too early. You want to complete your work so that you don't publish only to find a few months later that somebody improved significantly on your theory. There are cases like this. I've heard one in mathematics. Somebody published a theorem, a proof, and somebody found an error in the proof, improved it, and the theorem is named by that second person. In my field, there was an algorithm proposed by a doctoral student. He defended his doctorate. I think he either proved it incorrectly, the algorithm, or just proposed an algorithm without proof. And a scientist who proved that the algorithm is correct, the algorithm is now named after him. So sometimes it is tough. You have to be very careful when you publish. You want to be first, but not earlier. You want to have the work done. It's, the original movie was called The Race to Catch a Buckyball. When it first was made, the movie, many scenes are from that original movie. They didn't get the Nobel Prize, but they talked about them already because it was an important discovery. The movie that you watched from YouTube, it was composed, put together already after they had gotten the Nobel Prize. So it's a race. Scientists are in a race. Everybody wants to be the first. At some point, paper after paper was produced. Remember, they were showing different aspects. Different people were talking about different experiments and different aspects of that discovery. Paper after paper. Hoffman and Kretschmer. Kretschmer was the German guy. Hoffman was the one from Arizona. They thought back about their old experiments where they gave up. the two spikes, they thought it was junk. They thought about their old experiments, and they found easily a way of actually extracting the buckyballs and observing them under electronic microscope. That's something that happened. Croto and Smalley, the two Nobel Prize winners, created incredible competition once they had this discovery. A question that we may talk about later in the context of writing or ethics. Smalley had the lab. Remember, Croto went back to England after the failed attempts to create the buckyballs in the restaurant. And Smalley advanced more, right? So he actually was the one who proposed that they are those geodesic spheres. Could he have published on his own after he has constructed the first fullerene? Not an easy question, of course. Of course he could, but it would not be very collegial. He worked with Croto for a while. A lot of ideas were Croto's. It would not be very nice, it would not be ethical to publish things on his own. It would not be nice. It's often, and also when you work with somebody, it's very difficult to say whose idea it was. So when you work with your advisor now, after a year or two or three working, it's going to be very difficult to actually pinpoint whose ideas they were in the joint work. It's almost like with marriage. Two people marry, they have children. And then they start quarreling, they start divorcing, right? You must have met people like that. They will say, oh, you know, this child, this character feature, that's after his father, right? The bad character feature. And the fact that he's so smart, that's me, right? Everybody has the temptation to say that. Very, very difficult. You know, when you produce children, you know, they are a combination of the father and mother. Very difficult to distinguish after whom they inherited good and bad character features. The same with things that you produce in science. When you have a paper, you work together with your advisor, for example. After a while, it's very difficult to say, oh, this was my idea, this was his idea. There was, when I was in Pittsburgh once, there was a visit from a Polish actor. What's his name? Sztur. I think he's dead already. You know, he had, like every human being, a complex things of good and bad things. But one of the things that I find sometimes in the celebrities, oh boy, he was so full of himself, so proud. He presented a movie, there was like a small festival, he presented a movie, Big Animal, about a guy who had a camel, and then he had all kinds of problems with that camel in a small town. He directed that movie, it was based on a screenplay by Kieślowski. Kieślowski, as you know, a brilliant director, created many brilliant movies in 1980s. And there was, after the movie, questions, answers, and somebody asked about a scene in the movie. And he said, well, you know, what could I do? The screenplay was like this, right? It wasn't the best scene, but, well, I had to do it. It was a screenplay. And somebody asked about another piece that he or she liked a lot, and he said, oh yeah, that scene was not in the screenplay, you know. It was he was so full of himself. I actually came late for that movie because I had a lecture, and I couldn't get in because all the seats were taken, so I just waited for my wife outside, and I sat next to him and his wife. Oh boy, I think they were both very full of themselves. Me, who always starts chatting with somebody, that chatting ended after a couple of sentences. I just opened my laptop and started working. Anyway, when you create something, it's very difficult to say whose it is. Only when you are very full of yourself, so good things are yours, bad things are theirs, right? Like in case of Stur or divorcing parents. So it's very difficult to do that. There's one real actual case. I had a series of papers with one of my students, and they were good, really good ideas and good papers. So I was in a meeting with that student, and I said to him, wasn't it a good idea that I had to do this? There was an important step in that, in the algorithm we proposed. He looked at me and said, I think I proposed it. And I actually don't know who proposed it. Really, I don't know. So I just smiled, laughed. Yeah, maybe you proposed it. I don't remember. I thought it was me. But I didn't argue. It was completely useless to argue. It doesn't matter. He and I were meeting for a couple of years, regularly, every week. And I honestly don't, I cannot, I think it was my idea, but I cannot guarantee that. I don't know, you know, whose idea it was. So it's very difficult whose idea it is. So when you work with somebody, you talk with somebody about something, then you essentially have to accept the idea that it's a joint product. That the children of your marriage are a joint product of your husband and you, or your wife and you. You cannot start talking, okay, good character features of the child are mine, bad are his, right? You cannot do that. It's very difficult. When you start working with somebody, you essentially have to accept the fact that the product of your work is joint. And it's very difficult to split that product. To say, okay, I'm publishing about this, you publish about that, and then we are splitting. Almost like dividing a child in half, yes? Which is in a biblical story about Solomon, remember? Divide the child into two. Give each of the women one part. You cannot do that. So could he have gone on his own? Yes, he could, but it would not be very nice. It would not be ethical. And they would have a quarrel, probably. That would not be nice. She shouldn't have done it, and he didn't do it. So he essentially contacted Kroto immediately, said, well, look, we have found a way of constructing those fullerenes. And then they continued with writing the paper together. You cannot go off on your own when you have met with your advisor. Well, what's the lesson? The lesson is, if you don't like your advisor, if you don't trust your advisor, don't work with it, right? Very tricky issue in this program, because it's very difficult to change your area. I know it. Very tricky. So if you want to complete your studies without too many problems, you'd better put up with your advisor for the 4 years. Although there are cases where a student changed, the advisor changed the topic, but it wasn't easy. The same with marriage, you know, before you have children, before you produce something, make sure that your fiancé, whether it's woman or man, doesn't matter, that you want to have a child with them. When I was a child, still there were the genetic tests were not very well, they were not very popular. I remember one of the older person I spoke to, maybe a teacher, maybe my mother, I forgot. If a man sleeps with a woman, and the woman is pregnant, has a child, just the fact that he slept with her is his child, right? Whether she had other partners doesn't matter, you know? So be careful what you're doing, what kind of, you know, engagements you have. The same with science. If you don't like somebody, don't work with them. But when you start working with somebody, you have to go all the way. I mean, whatever you produce is going to be common. The world is small. There are no real boundaries. So Smalley could fly, Kroto could fly to Texas. What was the name of the guy? Huffman flew to Black Forest. You saw the PhD students from all kinds of foreign countries working for Exxon, no boundaries. When you get a doctorate, you can practically work anywhere in the world. The question is, of course, do you want to do it? But if you want to do it, you can get a position in many places in the world. You want to work in Singapore? They always look for smart people. You want to work in India, in China? I'm sure that they will also accept you. It's enough to have a good doctorate, good publications, do good work. They will want you everywhere. Good education is always opens the world to you. Networking, very important, you know, finding places for sabbatical leaves. Every university gives you, at least in US and probably many European countries, I don't know if it's in Poland also, in US, after working for 6 years, you have the right to spend one semester at full salary, so they pay you your full salary for one semester, you can go anywhere in the world. You can find a supplemental salary over there if you want to. You can go for a whole year, that also is your right, but then they will pay you just half of your salary. So one semester, if you go for 2 semesters, you need to spread that over 2 semesters. And that's a right, most universities have that. I use that always generously. I spent entire year somewhere else after 6 years, always. Why is it? It's to generate ideas, essentially. That's the university's benefit. You go somewhere, you learn new things, you bring them back to the university. That's the idea there. How do you find a place to go to? Without a network, you cannot do that. Because very rarely they will publish, we are looking for somebody for a sabbatical leave to come to us. No, people don't do that. But when you write them, I have funds for a sabbatical leave. Can I come and spend a semester with you? Often they will. It's much easier to approach somebody you know, somebody you met, somebody you know from their research. And typically you should go to places that will advance your research, your career. You go to a place that has a bigger accelerator, bigger lab, more funds, so that you can learn more. A friend, somebody who attended a workshop, a conference, Kroto. Okay, Kroto gets a copy of a paper from a friend. Remember, he wrote him, presented at Capri. Do you believe it? Right. A friend sent him. If he had no friend, he would never have gotten it. A friend knew that Kroto is working on this and just sent him the paper. Very practical thing, very important thing. Later he gets a paper to review also because people know he is an expert in this area. Another thing that is worth pointing in that movie is the structure of a lab. If you noticed, there was Smalley in the Texas lab, and they show one or two doctoral students. Remember that? There was a doctoral student who was doing the experiments, putting things together. He was explaining the experiments. In the movie they showed like he was running between different rooms, bringing things, doing the dirty work. There's a structure in typical labs. So we have, depending where, in the US it's a professor and doctoral students. That's it. And you may have master's students doing some master's thesis, typically supporting the work of the doctoral students. Professors are very autonomous. When I finished my doctorate and got my position as an assistant professor, I was completely autonomous, independent. No boss above me, really. I could do whatever I wanted. At least I decided to do what I wanted. Nobody was complaining. I decided to create a lab, give it a name, created a web page. At some point, remember a few months later, the department chair asked me, oh, you created a lab? I said, yeah. That was, you know, doing and asking later. I don't think I would need a permission there. I don't know, who knows? Now, that structure may be different in Poland. I noticed that there is more hierarchy and there are several layers. There is the rector, dean, there is there is then there are groups like cathedra, then run typically by a full professor. There are several professors there, and then they have doctoral students, maybe assistants, etc. There's a much bigger hierarchy than that. But you saw the hierarchy. Doctoral students in typical places are at the bottom of the food chain, that they call it. It's a funny expression. Being at the bottom of the food chain is, you know, like a plankton in the sea. Everybody eats them. So the small fish eat that, bigger fish eat the small fish, and then, you know, sharks and whales eat that bigger fish. So doctoral students are usually at the bottom of the food chain, in the sense of them working very hard, doing all kinds of, you know, the daily work, setting up experiments, etc. And you might think that this is exploitation of the doctoral students. You can look at it that way. But if you believe it's exploitation, why don't you go on your own? On your own is very hard. So it's actually a symbiosis. You are learning a lot being in that environment, and hopefully your advisor, your mentor, is teaching you stuff. You are learning. You are putting the first steps. So you are doing a lot of kind of basic daily work, but you are also learning. That's the thing that you are getting in return. So somebody has to do the dirty work. Typically, it's students, doctoral students. We'll talk about running a lab, being a boss. I have a presentation on that later. Well, I will try to tell you that a good mentor, good leader of a lab, a professor, it's not a bad idea to actually bring yourself down to the level of the doctoral students and be a colleague. When we had to do, for example, cleaning the kitchen, we had a very nice lab with a kitchen, a refrigerator, that was very nice. Somebody had to clean that kitchen, you know, a group of mostly men. You won't believe what they can make out of the kitchen, how dirty can it be. We had duties. Every week there was somebody whose task was to clean the kitchen. I was not escaping that task. I, you know, every so often, I was also the one cleaning the kitchen. That was a good example. You know, a good leader does not tell to his soldiers, attack over there. Good leader says, come on, go after me, you know, goes there. Doesn't avoid anything that he or she asks of doctoral students. So, but there is hierarchy, and somebody has to do the dirty work, right? I haven't done any programming for the last at least, 30 years maybe. I had some programming maybe when teaching classes, but most of the development work was done later by my programmer, by doctoral students, not by me. So programming is dirty work. Well, in a way it is, basically. Scientists in U.S., you may have noticed that probably majority is foreign-born. They are not U.S. Americans-born scientists. Well, Smalley was American. I keep forgetting the name of this guy. Huffman was American. But there are many foreign-born scientists. I work with people from all over the world in different positions. So when I first came to U.S., I was working at IBM, a big research center. The head of that whole research center was an Israeli from Israel. Of course, he got his doctorate probably in U.S. and then spent many years. Then the president of Carnegie Mellon was Indian for quite a while. The several people in my department, professors, were also from all over the world, really. So, all over the world. Very, very international. They are interested always in bringing the best people. Doesn't matter where they are. Now, the typical careers, another thing that you could have noticed, several of the people work at universities. Huffman, I think, University of Arizona, then Croteau, I forgot, Sussex or somewhere in England, Croteau, Smalley, Texas, universities. But then there were industrial research labs. You notice that when they were showing Exxon, only Exxon, or was there some other place? I forgot. But they showed you also a typical industrial research lab. We didn't see much in the movie, but people with doctorates also work in startup companies. They go into business with good ideas. They create something, companies, and if they succeed, and at some point they will succeed. If not the first and the second or third company, they will become wealthy. You cannot not become wealthy if you work hard and keep generating ideas. So these are the three typical destinations of people with doctorate. In Poland, typically, you think probably about working at a university, which is perfectly fine. And the reason why that is the case is that we don't have in Poland too many industrial research labs. In US, there are many very large research labs. When I came to US, it was late 1980s, I was working for IBM. IBM had in one building or complex of buildings 1,400 scientists. Most of them had a doctorate. 1,400 scientists. Amazing. And then Exxon, I suspect there were also a few hundred scientists working there in that building. You saw just a sample of them working on that topic. So these are the industrial research labs outside of the universities. And startup, I don't know how many, 20% of the doctorates end up, 20, maybe 30, end up in startups. Because there's not enough room for them in universities and industry. In terms of difficulty of following each of the paths, in US, definitely, it's the hardest to get into academia. Of course, there are different universities. There are top universities, there are kind of middle, and then weak universities. Weak often focus on teaching, less on research. It's very difficult, very competitive to get a position at a research university. Middle, maybe it's easier, and then the teaching universities maybe the easiest. So some people end up there. That's not a very good thing for the career, I think. It's always good to aim high, to go to the best places. In any case, the universities are definitely most prestigious, good universities. Then research centers, I guess there are some prestigious research centers. IBM Watson Center, where I worked, was definitely very good, very prestigious. There is Xerox PARC. You know, it's a research center of the Xerox company that created the copying machines. They have they also have a lot of good papers coming from there. AT&T Bell Labs, another very prestigious, very good research center. Microsoft Research in Washington. It's also well known, also many people working there. Google, I think they have a small research center in Poland also, in Kraków, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe some of you will end up working there. So there are some prestigious research centers, and that's that second thing. And then other companies will hire a PhD because of the knowledge, of the ability to read and literature, to conduct experiments. That will happen. There are also non-conventional paths. People who have doctorate, they end up, for example, being politicians or being writers. You see many politicians in Poland who have doctorates, right? Our president, the president of Warsaw has also a doctorate, yes? Kaczyński has a doctorate. So there are people who got their doctorates, but actually their career shifted in another direction. You can become a politician, you can become a writer, you can be a politician and still keep working at a university or take a leave of absence and go back. President Duda had also a doctorate, I think. Kwaśniewski didn't even have a master's degree, right? He claimed he had. It varies, but people with doctorate can also do things that are not typical. The next thing that is also inspired by the movie, but it's not exactly the focus of the movie, But you definitely notice that is what I call a social character of science. I mentioned that last week. The important thing here that I wanted to mention is that I kind of think about my own thinking when I was a young person before the doctorate, you know, when I was a student. I also think in this context about my sons of a professor, of a scientist, and sons, of course, like every teenager. Being teenager, by the way, is a mental state. My sons were teenagers when they were in their teens, but sometimes I see elements of being teenagers when they are in their 20s, you know. People often, these days, they become adults very late, really. In any case, when they were teenagers at the dinner table, we were sometimes talking about science, about some issues. Very often I noticed that, of course, I wasn't an authority for them. A father can never be an authority for a teenager. They were talking about issues, and they were completely surprised about my position on those issues. So they would use arguments like, you know, but science says this, science says that, which is a ridiculous argument, as if science was kind of black and white logic. Science says this, science says that. That's absolutely not the case. What does it mean, science? There is no authority like God above us. We have a hypothesis. We are studying something. We are writing a paper. We ask God, God, tell us, is this correct or not? There's no authority like that. So we produce something, and who judges that it is good, worthy publishing, worth giving money? Other scientists, who are also humans like us, with all their good and bad things, their flaws and other things. Whether you get a doctorate is also judged by other people. There's no central authority that you can go to. Sometimes maybe it happens. I noticed in Poland, it's surprising to me, lawsuits, a student, I've never seen it firsthand, but I heard of it. A student is suing the university or the advisor, whatever, for something, with the hope that the judge will be the authority on the subject of the quarrel. That's kind of a funny thing, really funny to me. By the way, it's a waste of time. I would never do anything like that. In any case, there is no central authority. There is nobody that will tell you that you are right or wrong. It's other people, other scientists. So when you write a paper, you send it to a journal. The journal editor sends it to a few reviewers. How do they select the reviewers? Well, they look often at the list of references in your paper, the citations. And they see, oh yeah, it looks like this guy is working on the same problem. Why don't I send the paper to him or her? Yes. So they pick a few people. They send that paper, ask, can you please review the paper for us? And, you know, they are people too. They have no time. Do you have a lot of time? No, you don't have much time. They will spend a few hours, maybe, if you are lucky, maybe a day on your paper, probably a few hours. They read it. They may misunderstand your paper. They may reject it for wrong reasons. They may accept it for wrong reasons. It's a mess, isn't it? Completely subjective, in a way. That's the social character of science. Your doctorate is going to be judged. Not only your advisor will make a statement about it. Typically, your advisor will like your doctorate. If your advisor doesn't like your doctorate in the fourth year of your studies, then you are not in a very good shape, I would say. You should at least convince your advisor that what you have done is a good piece of work. If you haven't done that, maybe you should do more, I guess. It may be the case that the advisor is unreasonable, but I think it's much more rare than the case that you haven't done enough. But both can happen, of course. Then your doctorate gets sent to the department council, Rada Naukowa, will pick three reviewers for your doctorate somewhere in Poland or outside of Poland. Good idea to write your doctorate in English. They will send it to those people, give them a couple of months, 2-3 months, to review your doctorate and write an opinion about this. Can they be wrong? Sure, they can be wrong about your work. They can be wrong in both ways. They can say it's bad work, or they can say good work. In both cases, can they be wrong, right? Depending on... So there is no central authority, and science is actually full of disagreements, of different opinions. It's difficult to realize, right, from this ideal picture of science, that science is like this. Now, that's the bad news, the negative view, like, you know, it's all social character. The good news is that in the history of science, there were mistakes, there were wrong papers rejected, good papers rejected wrongly, there were bad papers published, they later turned out to be bad papers, the theory was false, etc. But in the long run, good work usually reaches the audience. So if you are doing good work, even if you get a bad review from somebody, don't get discouraged. If you know that you are doing good work, listen carefully to the criticism, correct it, keep pushing. In any case, social science, social character, whether you have made big contributions, whether you have done good work, will be judged by other people, sometimes after you have died already, right? So sometimes it's late, too late. If your paper should be published, if you should get money, is judged by other people. Money is always a delicate issue, of course. There is not enough money. So there is always some conflict of... often there is conflict of interest. If you get the money, they will not get it, right? So they try to... in reviewing, they try to be reasonable, of course, but if they notice some flaws, they will definitely bring them up. Other things too, like tenure. Tenure is a permanent position in a university. In US, you start as an assistant professor. After 6 years, you get a major review, and you get a permanent position or not. If not, you have to go somewhere else. You have to leave the university. If you get a permanent position, they cannot fire you. So no matter what you do, they cannot fire you. Well, there may be some cases where they can. I don't know what they would be, maybe some latent case of sexual harassment or racism, you know, really like things that are considered to be big crimes, or gross incompetence. They might fire you, but it's not easy. In any case, not because of your political convictions or because of the type of work that you're doing. Permanent position, tenure. Research space, very delicate issues in universities. Every university, every department has limited space. And you would like to have desk for you, for your students, you'd like to have a lab. If you get that, will be decided by your colleagues at the university. Again, social thing. It's all going to be judged by your peers. A peer is an English word for meaning people like you, people equal to you. It is used often in court, a jury of peers, so a jury that judges whether you are guilty or not, are people like you, selected from the society. Although not exactly like you, if somebody is a criminal, the members of the jury are not necessarily criminals, of course, but people like you. Oops. Doctorate also. People will decide about this. And of course, science is not free of people who are bad, who have bad intentions. They use the word scoundrel, which is, I'll show you the translation into Polish. But although I think that there are not so many people who are scoundrels in science as there are in other disciplines, because the rewards for being a scoundrel is not very high in science. Here are some synonyms of scoundrel. You know, there are people like this, definitely, because it's a social activity, and wherever there are people, there are also people of all kinds of orientations and, you know, morality. I think there are more scoundrels in politics than there are in science. Probably the rewards. In politics, you can get closer to the to where you can get some money, some benefits, some bribes. Here in science, not really. I mean, if you do something illegal, unethical, if they find you, you will lose your reputation. If they don't find you, what will you gain? A paper? What is it worth, you know? So this is it's the same thing, actually, the translation. I couldn't help putting this years ago when there was this affair of recording some politicians, the tape affair around 2014, I think. Co minister to świństwo rej. Every minister has his pig's face. Now, just a few slides showing the basic mechanisms in science. So we have the social character, but there are certain rules of the game. One of the things that is very important is scientific publications. So sharing the results of your work. It's a basic mechanism of communicating results. And I'm going to list some in the direction of the increasing prestige. So you start with oral presentations. We'll talk about presenting. It's a good idea to learn how to present because it's the cheapest for you. You go somewhere, you present your work. It will cost you maybe a few hours, a few days of preparing slides, and then you present. You may convince some people, tell about yourself. It's not very prestigious. It's nice to have it in your resume that you gave a talk at Harvard or Oxford, and so it's nice, but not terribly prestigious because nobody is reviewing it. You are just deciding about what you are going to talk about and you are presenting. The next thing is similar, but it's written. So you can write something. You can publish it as a web page or a technical report. Many departments have a technical report series. They can give you a number, and it's a technical report number 2026-03-07. Yes? It has a number. People from outside can ask for a copy, etc. Although these days you can put it on the web also, as a web page or as a paper. Not very prestigious. You can list it in your resume, in your vita, but the prestige is not very high because nobody has reviewed it. Books. People may argue whether books are next in line. There are some fundamental pieces of work that were published as books for the first time. They are meant to provoke, to stir up, to disseminate a new view of a discipline. Sometimes they summarize years of your work that was published earlier. No reviews except for the publisher often sends a few copies of the conspect or maybe the draft asking for a review, but they usually look at the commercial potential, the publisher. The question is, will it sell? Will there be many people interested in that book? Another thing, another type of review that you get is after it has been published, there may be reviews in magazines reviewing a book. Somebody, another scientist, read that book and writes his or her opinion about the book. I'm, of course, joking about stupid review, because the first reaction to reviews of every human is, oh, they're so stupid. They don't understand it completely, right? I mean that. Sometimes they don't understand your work, but very often reviews are useful. Although here, it's the review is written after the book has been published. You are not going to change your book unless you publish a second edition. The next thing is workshops, symposia, annual meetings of an organization, things that are conferences where there is no peer review. Usually you send an abstract or you share short paper. They will accept it or not. Typically the decision is based on subjective criteria of the organizers. Interesting work, ties nicely into the topic of the workshop, good place, I know this person, you know, these are the criteria. Sometimes there is a very, very brief review, but not very precise. So the prestige is also not very high. Then there are peer-reviewed conferences. They are reasonably fast, and they can be very reputable. When you look at the points, list of points published by the ministry, very often they have a lot of points, 100, 140, 200 points, some of the conferences. The review process is very good. They send your paper to several people who are really top researchers in that field, who are in the program committee of the conference. Every field has, well, maybe not every, but many fields have those prestigious conferences. It's a good idea to publish there, not easy to get in. When you get a review, there is actually no time for arguing, because they send you a review with the decision, reject or accept. Sometimes, I've seen several conferences where there is a discussion period, 1 or 2 weeks, where you can argue with the reviewers. You can do that, but I've never seen in my experience the reviewers changing their mind about acceptance or rejection. Somehow, there is an argument, but I've never seen them reverse the opinion. So when I get a negative review in such a conference, I already know that the paper will not be accepted. Then there are journals, the highest in prestige. They call it archival publication, archival journal, because journals get to libraries, you can find them, they are well indexed. Typically they are slow but reputable, so reviewing process may take longer. Of course they are subject to stupid reviewers, but you can argue with them. Here I've seen discussions where reviewers sometimes agreed on the response and withdrew their criticism. There are two important things here. This is an older view where journals were indeed very slow. There is a whole breed of journals these days that are very fast. They give you they make a decision within 1 month after submission, 1 or 2 months. That's incredible, incredibly good. And very often people call it predatory journals. So they are essentially making money. You have to pay money when they publish your work. And my opinion was quite negative from the very beginning. I thought, well, you know, this I'm not going to bother even not publish. I'm getting every day invitations to publish somewhere here and there. I always ignore it. I have a small experience. I published with my wife. We had to publish very quickly because of a faculty review in the university. We had to get something very quickly. So we sent two papers to an MDPI, I think, or MDDP journal. It's an organization that publishes several journals. And I must say, I have to admit that the reviewing process wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. So the reviews were quite thorough, and it kind of, my opinion about it kind of increased a little bit. But there is, in the old school, and still probably, there is a concept of leading journals. Science, Nature are absolutely leading. Publishing there is an enormous prestige. Every field has leading journals. Journals that are publishing only the best work. If you publish there, your name gets quickly out. If you want that your name gets quickly out, publish in places like this. And there are also obscure journals that are, you know, they don't have that good of a reputation. It's okay to publish there once in a while, but in your career you should not publish too much in this kind of journals. If you want to develop your career fast into really good, solid career, try to publish in leading journals, maybe good journals, good at leading, and absolutely go to the peer-reviewed conferences, and it's okay to go to some of the workshops that are very specialized. Workshop precisely in your field. You want to show your face there, you want to be there, present your work, definitely. I was advised against publishing books when I was starting, just after my doctorate. An older colleague told me, books are not a good deal because they take a long, long time to write, to edit, to publish, and the benefit from books is not very high. So I never really published the book. I wanted to at some point, but I never pushed to do that. So present a lot, that's very cheap. Occasionally you can publish something if you want to assure that you have a trace that you were the first. You can sometimes publish it internally as a technical report at the same time that you send it to a journal. Go to specialized workshops and symposia, but don't go to conferences just because they are in Hawaii and you want to go to the beach. Don't do that. So go to places only for which there is a reason for going. Definitely here and definitely leading and good journals. So that's the ideal combination. Definitely going to conferences is a good idea because it's fast and you will meet people personally. You can build your network. Three mechanisms of science. The second is grants. Grants is giving money, essentially. It's one of the basic mechanisms in science. And it means essentially allocating a piece of limited resources, giving you money to do work. And it's amazing what you can do with money. You can buy computers. You can send your doctoral student to a conference, to some exotic place. Not because it's an exotic place, but it's a good conference. You can travel, equipment, you can pay for publications, a lot of things that you can do. So you really want to get money in the long run, depending where, but in US, in order to get tenure, to become a permanent employee, you need to show that you are able to get money. Because money is so important for the university also, they want you to bring money. Where do you get money from? And countries are different, of course. In US, there are prestigious sources of money. National Science Foundation is one. In Poland, Fundacja Nauki Polskiej. They have good, strict review process. When you get money from there, it's not just money, but you can also say, well, I got money from National Science Foundation, Fundacja Nauki Polskiej, which means that some scientists who were reviewing your grant application liked it. They acknowledged that this is good direction, good work. In health sciences, biology, in US, there is National Institute of Health, a very good place to get money, also very strict review, very prestigious. Then in US, not in Poland, I think, but in US you can get money from military agencies. Military agencies are very interested in good research because they put it into weapons, of course, at some point. So they also have money to fund you. I received money for a couple of years from DARPA and for several years, maybe 8 or 10 years from Air Force. Good money, easier to get, but also it was basic research. Basic research that is for everything. Of course, military is also interested in that. I didn't do anything secret, anything that would be considered proprietary, really only for the military. Then there are foundations. You can find them also in Poland, I bet. Foundation interested in reducing incidence of cancer or getting better treatment of cancer or some other social or medical issues. Usually smaller money. In US you can get hundreds of thousands of dollars, sometimes millions from these. These are typically on the order of several tens of thousands of dollars. Industry can give you grants. I got grants twice from industry. On the order also, we got $100,000 roughly. Not a lot of money. In any case, it's a good idea to get money because you can do a lot of things with it that help your research, your laboratory, whatever you're doing. The third mechanism in science is peer review. Peers, I explained that these are people like you, so other scientists. They are judging your work. They are working in the same area. You don't know who they are. It's used in scientific publications, but also in financial resources, so in grants. So both of the previous mechanisms use that mechanism. You have to watch out for conflicts of interest. There's a basic conflict of interest. The people who are most qualified to judge your work can also benefit from your work most, right? Because they are exactly in that field, and if you have good ideas, they can easily assimilate them. So the process is a little bit dangerous. It's not perfect because people can steal your work, consciously or unconsciously. Some people do it unconsciously. You essentially find the idea so good that you are convinced that it must be yours. So it's imperfect, but as I said, good things will eventually get out to the world. So in the long run, it is working. Do it well. The moment you start publishing, people will start sending you papers to review. Because they will see your name, people will cite you, they will send you papers to review. You should treat other people the way that you would like to be treated. That's a good criterion. Don't write, this work is poor. Would you like to get a review like this? No. You write, in this place, there is an error, right? This direction is not very promising. He writes concrete advice to help the author. If you criticize somebody's work, you should be able to show a superior approach. You are not an oracle. You can be also wrong as a reviewer. Try to do your best and argue. When you make a statement, argue why. What is expected of you as a scientist? So we talked about the mechanisms, how it works, the basic things. What is expected of you? People expect from you a few outstanding quality contributions rather than a flow of dubious quality writings. With the point system we have in Poland, there is the temptation of, you need to get whatever, 200 points every year, suppose it is 200. You can go for a top quality journal that has 200 points. But it's risky. You don't know if it's going to be accepted. It has to be good work, etc. Much easier to send 4 papers for 50 points each. Much easier to get it published. Bad strategy. Because you can get a reputation of somebody who is essentially producing a lot of dubious quality writings. It's much, much better to focus on a small number of quality contributions. It's okay to publish some things that are once in a while that you think good work but not good enough for the top, so you publish it somewhere. But don't publish too many of these. People will figure it out looking at your work. So small number, high quality contributions. Some people published just a handful of papers, became very, very famous because of the quality of the work. Your colleagues expect from you honesty, integrity, and reliability. When you say you are going to be there, when you say you are going to review something by a certain date, try to do it. Your reputation will influence people in other ways. When you are dependent on them, they will really be influenced by your honesty, integrity, and reliability. Good idea. People will let their respect for you as a person influence their respect for you as a scientist. So, as I said, try to be good. Be nice to other people. Then you will not need to store all the knowledge that you need in your head. You can always, if you have an idea that is bordering with biology, you call your friend biologist and they say, well, I have this idea, what do you think about it? Then you don't need to learn biology yourself because you can ask well-informed opinion of somebody else. Having friends is a good idea, being nice to them. In one of the research design textbooks, I saw the following. This is really a quotation. Be nice to other people because you will not need to be afraid that somebody pisses in your cultures when you are not in the lab, doing something kind of against you. Being punctual, reliable, answering your email quickly, good idea again. So, this is not pure science, but things that are helping you with becoming a better scientist. Next week, I'm planning to focus on identifying research problems. So that's the next thing. No movie to watch. There will be one when we talk about career planning. Where is it? Career planning. We're going to jump here. There's a very nice lecture, very difficult to follow, but it is definitely very, very nice to watch. In any case, finding research topic. Very important thing is because in the beginning, your advisor will help you to find a topic to identify something for a paper, but in the long run, you have to learn it yourself. So I'm going to share with you some of the things that I have learned from my advisors about how to do it. Let's see. That's all I wanted to say today, I think. And do you have any questions? Anything that you've been very quiet? No, no questions. Okay. Sometimes, as I said to you last week, sometimes you will find the things that I'm talking about obvious. But remember, you are looking for those things that you didn't know, the few things. And hopefully you will get them in every meeting that you have. It will be something that that is going to be interesting for you. Great, thank you very much. The list... Was it going to go? Okay.